Each week, I take a thought leader out to lunch at a locally owned restaurant, and we talk business, politics, and more. This week, I'm out to lunch with John Norris, whom I have known for decades. John is a partner of the State Public Policy Group and most recently ran in a crowded field for the Democratic nomination for governor of Iowa. Prior to that, he was with the USDA, the United Nations, was chief of staff to former Governor Tom Vilsack, followed Governor Vilsack to Washington, where he served as chief of staff to Secretary Vilsack of the USDA. We've got lots to talk about, from politics to public policy to sustainable agriculture, family, and more. And you, yeah, you, get to listen in. Out to Lunch with John Norris is just seconds away.
Insight on Business, the News Hour with Michael Libby, is made possible through the support of AARP Iowa. Real possibilities for people of every age. AARP Iowa and Country Vet Naturals. Loved by pets, trusted by owners. CountryVetNaturals.com.
Welcome back to the Business News Hour. This is our opportunity to go out to lunch with John Norris. We're going to flesh out more of his background here in just a bit. You may most recognize that name because he was one of several contenders for the governorship in Iowa back in, 16 or 18?
18.
Yeah. Just last year.
Yeah.
It seems like a million years ago, man.
It does.
Why is that? Why does it seem like it was so long ago?
You know, I suppose because it's over and now everyone's focused on the next election, and that's quickly becoming in the past.
Yeah, and that was a crowded field as well in Iowa, wasn't it?
It was. There were throughout the Democratic primary campaign, maybe 11 or 12 candidates.
Yeah, yeah.
Seven at the end, but
yeah, and it was quite an organizational effort. And so you got to travel all over the state of Iowa, of course, and see all kinds of people, and with a resonant message on not only what is important to urban Iowa, but also what's important to rural Iowa. And full transparency, I was a 100% supporter of your candidacy, and I think you would have made a fantastic governor. Just saying, okay? Get that off my chest.
Thank you, Michael.
Let's roll through, if we can, a little bit of your pedigree. You know, we talked a little bit about you were with the Harkin staff, Senator Tom Harkin, back when he was a congressman, and you were with Jesse Jackson when he ran for president here in Iowa in 1988, for crying out loud. And then what? Where did all of this take John Norris?
Well, I remained in policy development and politics and government for most of my life, with a little hiatus from the restaurant business for 5 years.
Yeah. Why not, right?
Yeah, why not? Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. Yes, if anyone out there is thinking about going in the restaurant business, please reach out to me. I'm happy to
call John first.
I consider it my MBA. And but I stayed in politics, ran Leonard Boswell's first campaign, was his chief of staff in Congress, was elected state chair of the Democratic Party in 1998, and led the effort to elect Tom Vilsack, the first Democratic governor in Iowa in 32 years. So I got.
Which was, by the way, can I backtrack here for just a moment? Mm-hmm. I will never forget. I was at the Montgomery County State Bank, the day, which happens to be in your hometown.
My hometown, yeah.
Yeah, of Red Oak, Iowa, the day after the election. And the president of that bank at the time, and I wish I could recall his name, but I just can't, was a very ardent supporter of Jim Ross Lightfoot.
It's probably Winnie Main, yeah.
And I remember walking into his office the day after the election, and his head was in his hands. And I said, "What's going on?" He says, "I cannot believe what the hell just happened." Because it was shocking, wasn't it?
It was shocked. No one expected Vilsack to win. Until the last few days, we saw it turning.
Yeah.
But it was great. I mean, like I said, we were the longest state in the country to have one party be in the governorship for 32 years. So
wow. It
blew folks away.
Yeah, and that was an exciting time. And then, of course, Tom Vilsack remained governor for eight years.
Yep.
Yeah.
I served as first chief of staff. Left there, and I ran John Kerry's campaign in Iowa in 2004, and then Vilsack appointed me to be chairman of our state utilities board, which really where I launched my passion for energy issues.
And then you also graduated from Iowa and went on with Secretary Vilsack. Would that be accurate?
I did.
What were you doing with the USDA?
Well, here's how it happened.
Yeah.
So shortly after the election, the president and first lady-elect called my wife, Jackie.
And who wouldn't, right?
Yeah, right. To ask her if she would join as a senior advisor to the president and chief of staff of the first lady. About a few days after that, word leaked out that they were going to nominate Tom Vilsack for Secretary of Agriculture. And so he called me and said, I got a hunch that you might be moving with your wife and kids to Washington, D.C., and would you mind serving as chief of staff for me again? So
Wow. It
was great. It was just a great alignment of everything, and great to be working with Tom again. And what a incredible federal agency that has such breadth across America, the USDA. So I spent a year there as his chief of staff while I was waiting for the Senate to confirm me to be a member of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. So I didn't expect it to take that long, nor did Tom. He basically said, come help me get started and stay as long as you can and want. But as politics go in Washington, I got held up in the U.S. Senate after my Senate hearings. Christmas Eve of 2009, they voted me out of the U.S. Senate and onto the commission for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I have to backtrack just a bit. Jackie went to work in the White House.
Correct.
Okay, so I have to ask the question. The relationship with First Lady Michelle Obama must have been something pretty amazing.
They had this tremendous connection on the campaign. Jackie was actually at the Obama's home in 2006 before he even announced. They brought Jackie in to help kind of counsel and advise Michelle Obama on what the campaign was going to be like.
Huh.
And she spent a lot of time in Iowa. Jackie spent a lot of time with her in Iowa. And they gained each other's trust. And so she had the great opportunity to join the Obama team at the White House.
It must have been a fascinating experience.
It was. It was.
You know, Pete Souza, every day he puts up a post on Instagram. You know, it's called Barack once a day, or Barack every day. That's what it is. And all of these photographs that Pete Souza, who is the White House photographer, especially for mm-hmm. President Obama, was fascinating images. And he's always got a little dig in there from time to time. Can you imagine?
We need a few more.
Can you imagine? All right, so you're on the Energy Commission, and you transition into the United Nations. Tell us about that.
I did. Well, I was serving on the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And interestingly enough, this is probably my first kind of public explanation of this. When I went on the commission, I was told by the Deputy Chief of Staff of the White House I'd be the next chairman of the commission.
Wow.
So I served for about 4 years. The chairman was leaving, and Henry Reid stepped in and demanded that he get to name the next chair, even though it's the president's prerogative. Harry Reid wanted someone from the West and someone who he knew and I think is somewhat associated with Yucca Mountain and the disposal of nuclear waste. And so Harry Reid put a hold on the president's nominee to head up the Securities Exchange Commission, Mary Jo White, and wouldn't let her get confirmed until the president backed off my chairmanship at FERC.
Really?
Yeah. So there's some insight into Washington
wow.
politics. So I went to work angry for about a year.
Yeah.
Partly because the word was broken with me. But more importantly, I'd been there, had the experience, and really had a lot of things I wanted to do to advance the cause for clean energy. And I wasn't able to do that. So Tom Vilsack and I sat down, and he knows my passion for agricultural and ag policy as well, and really the connection of the two. So he asked me if I would be willing to serve as the USDA's representative to the United Nations at the Food and Agriculture Organization. It took a presidential appointment, so he worked with the White House and got that change. So I was able to go back to agricultural issues and work and represent the U.S. there at the United Nations in Rome, Italy.
And when and you were several years in Rome, yes?
Yeah, a couple years, yeah.
Yeah? How's the pasta there?
Well, I'm always hesitant to order pasta now in the U.S., but yeah. Many great. It was a great experience for me working at the United Nations, and a great experience. Great experience for my family as well.
I was going to say your boys must have really enjoyed that, and Jackie, I'm sure.
They do, and just the exposure to different cultures, different parts of the world, that just enhanced their life immensely, and we're grateful for it.
Absolutely. Our guest, ladies and gentlemen, is John Norris. He's a partner with the State Public Policy Group. Is it hard, John? You've done all of these fabulous things in policy and politics. Is it hard to go back into private business?
No, it's not. I mean, yes, be honest, at times. At times, I do find what I like about my work at State Public Policy Group, I get to work on so many different issues and problem solve.
You got a little ADD going on?
Yeah, a little ADD, yeah. I suppose that's probably it.
That's my problem.
I guess the main reason Jack and I returned back to, I certainly had, you know, the offer to die for in D.C. and could make more money than this
sure.
farm kid from Southwest Iowa ever thought I could make. But that's not what motivates us. We really wanted to come back to Iowa. Number one, to raise our children here. But two is, you feel like you can make a difference. We saw so many times at the UN environment and the Washington environment, it's so hard. You see so many problems in the world, and to feel like you're having an impact can be a challenge. But here in Iowa, we really feel like we can have an impact.
I would agree with you. You know, yeah. There's 3 million people here, yeah. And sometimes it's better to be a small fish in a small pond, or
it
a big
is.
Fish in
yeah.
a small pond. However, that's
right.
But everybody matters,
right? And most local government has so much impact on people's lives, and local institutions, and Jackie's work at Goodwill, that this is what we learn, and this is what needs to feed up to our policymakers in Washington is how. What we do matters. Deal with the front line on issues that need to be addressed. So it feeds up, but right now we're feeding, working on solutions here in our community.
John Norris, ladies and gentlemen, we're out to lunch at Trostel's Dish talking about a whole raft of things. John, so you've spent time in politics, obviously. You've spent time in policy. Which is your favorite? What do you like to do? Is it the political thing? Is it the policy-making thing? Is it getting stuff done? What would it be?
Well, I enjoy probably the policy most because that's you've got to come up with ideas and solutions for addressing issues or advancing issues. But I think what makes me an effective policymaker, and I think what helps with policymaking is understanding politics. Because if you can't move something to become with a political support and force behind it, it gets so hard to move that policy forward.
Sure.
And so I think the combination is important to make policy work. You have to understand politics. But a reason I enjoy policy most is it's how you come up with solutions. And that's why I enjoy my work at the as chair of the Utilities Board and the Federal Energy Commission, because interestingly enough, while politics come into play,
it did.
At the end of the day, there's something called Ohm's Law, and there's physics. And yeah. While you want to be as aggressive as you can on promoting renewable energy, it still has to work at the end of the day, or the grid collapses. And so I think that kept policymakers in check and being about honest about what we can do on a day-to-day basis to move to a cleaner energy system, but recognizing there's physics involved.
John, when we talk about Iowa and renewable energy, Iowa's done a relatively good job at this. I believe, over 33% of our electrical power is now through clean energy. There are, three different ways you can do that? Solar, wind, and hydro, I would suspect. Is that?
Yes.
Roughly?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what do you think? How's Iowa doing on that regard?
Well, we're doing great. And, in fact, just today, the Midwest Governors Association announced that Governor Reynolds is going to be the new chair of the Midwest Governors Association, and Tim Walz, the governor of Minnesota, will be the vice chair. And their number one issue is going to be expansion of the transmission grid and promotion of renewable energies. So I'm very pleased to hear that. We will continue to see renewable energy both solar and wind grow at an increasing rate in this country. I think maybe the most surprising thing for folks is it is now the cheapest form of energy as well.
It is.
And so now we just need to develop, you know, we know what farm-to-market roads are to agriculture. The transmission grid is the farm-to-market road for renewable energy. And so if we can't get that power to the East Coast and the more urban centers who need it and want it, then we won't see it develop. So that's a critical piece that has to be done right now. But it's going to continue to grow because the economics are the number one driving factor, whereas a lot of the clean energy advocates have been about it for climate change. But now the economic argument supports it as well.
Well, the dollars rule. At the end of the day, you've got to do something that's going to impact the bottom line.
And if we ever have a cost on carbon, that'll just put this thing in
Explain that. Explain what a cost on carbon is.
Well, so a cost of carbon would be an assessment of those practices, primarily the burning of fossil fuels, that are increasing the CO2 and changing the climate and affecting the atmosphere, that we put a per tonnage cost. So if you produce so many tons or a ton of CO2 emissions or methane emissions or other climate change gases, causing gases, that there'll be a cost. So that'll, you know, it's currently called an external cost, right? We're not paying, we're creating it, but not paying for it, and it's not factored into the cost of energy. But if you factor that into the cost of energy, then it makes the solar and wind even that much more economically attractive.
I want to dial it back for just a moment. Here in Iowa, there was a move in the Iowa legislature, and we followed it relatively closely, where there was a move by some of the big energy folks to take a hard look at solar, indicating that people who had solar panels were not contributing to the grid, and therefore they should be... There should be an added tax on folks who are doing solar. That didn't succeed in the legislature. But what was the motivating factor, you think, behind that?
Oh, motivating factor. That's probably get me in trouble. But that's okay. That's who we're here for. Right? So I'll give a small partial bit of credit to the argument the utilities made, which is that when someone does have their own generating capacity, be it solar or wind, that our current rate structure does not fully reflect the cost of being on the grid.
Okay.
And so when you produce your own, you're not paying quite as much as perhaps your share of maintaining the distribution network and the transmission network.
Understand.
But here's the kicker. It is such a minuscule amount right now. If you look at Iowa and how much solar there is, it's still in infancy, the industry. But it's taking off. And there's now attributed like 8,000 jobs in Iowa associated with solar. They will kill that industry. And while over the next 20 or 10 or 20 years, we need to address that fair share cost, I question their motivation in killing it now.
Were they just trying to get ahead of it?
Yeah. Let's nip this in the bud before it cuts into our business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it'll take away from generation need. And they're in the business of producing electrons. They don't want competition. So I think they hijacked the issue to nip solar industry in the bud, to cut down their long-term degradation of their business model. But that business model has to change, and that's what has to change in Iowa and across the country so we can provide consumers the ability to produce their own energy at a fair cost.
Fascinating. It was a fascinating discussion to watch, and I know lots of money was poured into the public policy side of this to engage the public and the legislators about what was going on but it was fun to watch.
It was fun to watch because the outcome was good because it died.
Because it died. John Norris, ladies and gentlemen, we are out to lunch at Trostel's Dish, and in just a moment we'll flag down Nicole and see if we can order our lunch for today. When we talk about Iowa and Iowa politics, you ran for governor. You in a crowded field. You had all of this experience from Southwest Iowa, which tends, interestingly enough, to vote Republican. Of the 16 counties that are in the 3rd Congressional District, I think maybe two. One for sure can be counted on to go Democratic, which is Polk County, the county seat and or the largest county in the 16 counties. But the rest of them are pretty red.
Yes, the only Polk is the only county that Cindy actually won in her race. Yeah.
But by 33 or 35,000 votes, so, which would put her over the top. Has there ever been an idea of yours to run for Congress in the 3rd District?
No. Actually, in 2002, when I left Vilsack's office, I ran for Congress from Ames against Tom Latham. It was reapportionment.
Right.
It was a new good district, even though he was an incumbent. And traditionally, the year after George W. got elected, typically it would be a good Democratic year, but then 9/11 hit.
And turned everything around, didn't
and,
it?
And challengers across the country just got shut down.
Yeah.
So, you know, politics is a lot about timing. When I got in the governor's race, you know, after I got in, the guy who writes 6-7-figure checks to himself got in the race.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's a lot of this stuff's about timing. I don't know if I've been naive about choosing my timing or it's just happened.
Yeah. Well, sometimes when folks have a lot of money, things go in another direction. John Norris, ladies and gentlemen, we are out to lunch at Trostel's Dish and talking about all things political, so to speak. And with Jackie's work at Goodwill, this is your wife,
mm-hmm.
your entire family seems to be really rooted in service to others. Is that the mantra around the Norris household?
Well, it certainly is Jackie's household. Her dad was a teacher, her mom was a nurse,
right.
and she was a teacher before she went to work for the Obamas. My household were farm. I grew up a farm family, but my dad was really active.
He was, yeah. Oh, hey, Nicole.
Hello.
How's Nicole doing?
Wonderful. How are you?
I'm doing really well. So, how long have you been here, Nicole?
I actually just started last week.
Oh, and right away, we just put you right on the front lines, huh?
I said, lucky me.
Well, they put you back here because we know we don't bite or anything like that. So, so if you just started last week, gosh, wow.
I know.
That's like, you really got to play your game right?
Yes, I hope so.
All right, well, we know what we want.
All right, perfect.
So John Norris has got his order down. And what was it, sweet pea something?
Sweet pea risotto. See, I'm going with the pasta.
Sweet pea risotto, yeah.
A true test here.
There you go.
With a salad.
And what kind of dressing would you like? We have balsamic vinaigrette, raspberry vinaigrette, and a mustard vinaigrette or ranch.
Mustard vinaigrette.
Mustard?
And you know, I saw on the menu this grilled cheese sandwich.
Yes.
Yeah, I got to go with the grilled cheese sandwich and try that and the mixed greens.
Mixed greens, perfect. Anything else for you?
I'm good. John?
No, pressure's on. Cole.
Go, Nicole.
I promise.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, one of the things that we really enjoy doing when we do these out to lunch things, John, is getting, we're a month with our host, and we get to know the staff, you know, and talk with them. And that is really an interesting world, the whole world of servers.
Yeah.
Tough job.
It's a tough job, yeah. And, you know, part of my spending time in Europe.
Yeah.
And it's treated as more of a profession.
It is.
I mean, they get benefits. They get health care because they have a health care system. And they get retirement benefits. They get paid well. They don't tip in Italy, even though we still learned a habit, so we'd still tip, and they loved us. But because they get paid a living wage.
All right.
And so you saw the continuity. We saw people who were in food service in their 40s and 50s because they could make an honest, decent living.
Yeah, I have a friend who was born and raised in Austria. And they have several tracks in their public school system there. They have a vocational track and a professional track, or not professional, it's trades. Anyway, he decided to go into culinary arts and spent post-high school 3 years in culinary arts learning how to be waitstaff and a baker and a sommelier. And he says the exact same thing. You know, in Europe, Those people are venerated.
It's like an art to them.
It is an art. Yeah. Well, and the whole thing about going out to dinner in Europe is so drastically different than going out to dinner here. Here, the idea is to turn tables as fast as you can.
Yep.
And there, what do you do?
There, you are their guest.
Yeah.
So, in fact, ironically, sometimes you'd show up without a reservation, and they had plenty of tables available. They're like, "Oh, sorry, you didn't make a reservation."
Really?
You pay them the courtesy to tell them you're coming, and they treat you like a guest. I mean, that shocked us a bit.
Wow.
It happened a couple times, but they really want you to stay. There's no pressure to leave the table, and you're absolutely right. In the U.S., it's all about turn those tables,
right?
Keep that dollar volume up. And
as a former restaurateur, you would know about that, right?
Exactly.
What kind of a restaurant did you have?
Well, we had Don Stanley and I. We took over our
Don
own hotel.
Don Stanley. There's
hotel.
Another good
yeah.
name.
So we had too many drinks one night after the 88 campaign and decided to buy this old hotel in Greenfield. And it was a wonderful experience. Like I said, but I think 4.5 years we had it. We were in rural Iowa, but we tried to market as the place to go for special occasions.
Sure.
Cloth table cost, candles, flowers on the table, wait for staff in outfits. So that, you know, you get the higher end spender.
Right.
If it's someone's anniversary or birthday, they're going to go a little bit more extravagant. So that's how we tried to get the change the profitability factor of a rural restaurant. And we limped by for 4.5 years, and both of us. Here's the funny thing. We both left the restaurant business and both went back to law school.
Why not, right?
And law school felt like a vacation after the restaurant business.
You know, I have been to Greenfield numerous times, and the Hotel Greenfield, I believe that's...
Yes.
Yeah. And they have just... It's a beautiful place. Just a beautiful place. I don't know how many rooms, 14, 15, 16
yeah,
rooms,
about
something
that
like
many.
That.
That was my vision and dream.
Ah.
So we had the restaurant. The upper two floors were gutted out.
Yes.
But that was before historic tax credits.
Oh.
Which we passed in the Vilsack administration. But that enabled that town to get investment in that building and then connect it and restore the old opera house. And Greenfield just has
it's a
wonderful
place.
Prize right there on their down square. That's what I saw. I'm probably glad that they didn't pass until after I left because I might still be there in the restaurant
business. Still be there in the restaurant business. John Norris, ladies and gentlemen, let's talk a little bit about rural Iowa, shall we? Rural America, for that matter. We are seeing rural Iowa, rural America start to hollow out. 6 years now, I believe, of depressed commodity prices going on out there. Individuals who are aging in place. Farmers continue to age. Average age, I think, is 57 years old now. There are quality of life issues that people are worried about. There's health care delivery systems that folks are worried about. What do you hear when you're traversing back home, maybe in Red Oak or other places here in Iowa? What's on the minds of our friends in rural America and rural Iowa?
They don't see a very positive path forward. I mean, you cannot look at their trend lines and see what they're going through and expect a lot of optimism. I think they're at that critical point. We saw it in the 2016 election when they voted for Trump. We saw it in 2008 when they voted for Obama. Is government their partner or is government their enemy? And both those trade on that sense of we need hope, or, and I think what Obama instilled in voters, hopeful change. And what Trump capitalized on was blame game. If you don't look like me or talk like me, then you're the source of my problem and my insecurity. And so he's demonized the immigration population, I think, and helped drive a wedge amongst rural Iowans, whereas Obama won a lot of that rural vote by giving them hope that the government could be a partner about changing the dynamic for their future. If you look at races in Iowa, and I pointed this out throughout the Democratic primary, if you look from the 10 years prior, 2008, Democrats were winning, I think Obama won just short of 50 counties. Harkin won 80 counties, or 79 or 80. Vilsack and Culver in the 60s and 70s. But you look from 2010 forward, you know, Hillary Clinton won one.
Yeah.
Fred Hebel won 11. Jack Hatch won. Hillary Clinton won 6. Jack Hatch won 1. Bruce Bailey won about 11 or 12. All these statewide races since 2008, we have barely broken 10 county victories. Prior to 2008, the lowest was, I think, maybe Obama got 47. I'm close on that figure. What happened? We went from rural Iowa and seeing these trend lines and just losing hope about the future, and we haven't given them anything this past decade.
Are because, we even listening?
No. As a party, we've chosen. That's why I got them on their feet a couple weeks ago in Stewart, that Democratic meeting. I got them on their feet by saying, just send us some goddamn yard signs. You know?
So I mean, I remember.
That's how they feel. And if your ardent supporters and volunteers feel like you neglect them, what do you think the voters who barely pay attention feel like? And we have literally written off the rural vote, thinking we're going to make it up by increased margin in suburban Iowa. And as we saw in the last governor's race, the same consultants were given the same advice, and we got the same result, mm-hmm. which is the definition of insanity, right? Doing the same thing over and over again, expect a different result. No, if we don't pay attention to rural Iowa,
just write it off.
And more importantly than as a party, as a state, regardless of partisan politics, we as a state can't afford to maintain the physical and human infrastructure needs of all 99 counties if 85 of them are in decline.
Mm.
That puts too much burden. So it's in the state's interest. It's in the business person in Des Moines' interest, or the teacher in Cedar Rapids' interest, to have a strong rural economy.
Yeah.
So that's what we've got to focus on. And we can get into that.
Let me come back to that rural economy thing. But there's so many things. You as a farmer would know this. I mean, it's the only business in the world that you don't have control over your input cost or your price that you're selling anything. You just hope for the very best. And now we're 6 years into a downturn on commodity prices out there, corn and soybeans. And now we have a trade war where China, who used to import billions of dollars of agricultural products and soybeans, for example, to China, has now looked for places like Brazil. That can't help.
It can't help, but there are some lessons to be learned from this trade war. One is we were becoming too dependent on one foreign market to prop up a failing agricultural system and policies.
Interesting.
What we're doing right now is not sustainable. It's why I start on the Quick Bites, that book by David Montgomery, Growing a Revolution. It's
right.
About the soil. Our policies in agriculture for decades now have been driven by this notion that we're going to feed the world. Right? When I was in Rome, I had a farmer at a group of corn growers. One of them was a farmer from Iowa. We sat down at dinner, and he looked at me in all earnesty, and I believe him in earnest. John, we're about feeding the world. He's about growing these massive amounts of corn and soybeans to feed the world. The problem is, also when I was at the FAO, the United Nations, we had this internal debate, myself and about 12 other countries, about we were on this committee that dealt with the disposal of surplus commodities.
Okay.
Okay, and I was tasked by the State Department to close that committee down because it really, the State Department really watches unit expenditures, and it made sense to close it down because it really was a cost but didn't do anything. The work had already all gone over to the World Trade Organization. So it was a prudent move management-wise. It was a non-starter politically.
Right.
Because we have dumped our raw commodities on their markets for so many years, undermining their own farmers' capacity to make a living, that we've eroded their capacity to build their own food supply.
So rather than teaching them how to fish,
exactly.
We've been fishing for them.
That's right. That's right. And that has been fed by our agribusiness industry and the chemical industry because they want a farm policy that is all about more inputs and increasing that yield. And then so long that farm subsidies are based on how much yield you get per acre. And so you dump more on it, and you get more out of it, and you get more subsidies. But we've been in this hamster wheel for decades of high input, high output, no profit agriculture.
Mm.
And so The policies have been to backfill the farmer's pocket with subsidies to maintain this system that is helping really the grain traders and the input suppliers. Now, the frightening part now is what we're seeing in soil health. Is we've lost about 40% of our organic matter in our soil in the last 50 years, plus tremendous soil erosion. Since World War II, in this country, we have produced...
Lunch is here.
Okay.
Hold on. We
want to finish that thought?
Yeah, hold on just a second. This is the important part of this, because when you go out to lunch, we got to take Nicole's photograph here. All right, Nicole.
Hey, he looks skinny.
Perfect. All right, now that that's over with.
Do you want me to finish that thought and then have lunch?
Well, yeah, go ahead.
You,
finish
you
that thought.
Me.
Go.
So since World War II, we have produced in America nearly a billion tons of anhydrous ammonia.
A billion tons?
Think that. A billion tons. That's 1 billion times 2,000, right? Pounds. Most of it has been applied to our land to increase nitrogen
yield.
In the soil and yield. Well, what do you happens when you dump that much on
your
land?
Your organic matter
first,
goes to crap.
Yeah, first of all, you lose the Gulf of Mexico, and then it backs far enough up to get in the Des Moines and other cities' water supply and individuals' water supply, and it's killed the soil. That's why it's now dirt. And if we continue on this path of this high-input, high-output agriculture policies, which is giving farmers the only option they see to survive, then we're going to erode our capacity to have food production in Iowa. And this is also not like has happened throughout other civilizations. You know, even in Italy, I think it was year 1700 is when they had their soil eroded. They totally wiped out a whole...
potato famine in Ireland, and we can go on and on, yes.
So we have, I think we have to change all those policies, that they be driven by how you farm, not how much you produce, so that there's a public good for the public dollars being spent, and that public good is the restoration and the preservation of our soil health and our food production capacity, while at the same time you clean up our water supply, which is so critical for essential for life, right? And it's one of our huge assets. But we're eroding our two greatest natural resource assets in this state, our incredible topsoil and our incredible water supply. At the same time you're doing that by changing those farming practices, you're sequestering carbon and helping address climate change. And we've got to get that vision down, because that's an economic vision and an environmental vision and a quality of life vision that can change the dynamics of rural Iowa. And I think increase economic prosperity in rural Iowa and quality of life for the entire state.
You know, when you talk about water quality, John Norris, ladies and gentlemen, we're out to lunch at Trostel's Dish. When you talk about water quality, the mere fact that when they turn on the scrubbing machine in the Des Moines Water Works, $7,000 a day to scrub nitrates out of the water, which is fine for individuals who are drinking Des Moines water,
right,
but not so good for folks down in Ottumwa.
That's right.
So yeah, we're kind of in this together, I would think.
Well, even more so not so good for the folks upstream who don't even realize, either don't have the capacity to purify that water, or the increasing cost is going to be for smaller towns' water right. supply. Now, you do mention Ottumwa. You get down into the Lake Rathman watershed, I think you'll find that the cleanest man-made lake in the state, because they're not in this as row crop intensive.
The further south you go,
the further watershed. Yeah,
right. Yeah, that would
in fact,
be.
I choose now when I go fishing in Iowa at a reservoir to go to Rathman, because I know there's probably a better chance that the fish are not as dangerous for me to consume.
Oh boy,
John
that's
Norris. That's a sad state of affairs.
It is a
right?
sad state. Now you have to worry about where you go fish.
Exactly. Nice.
Holy cow. All right, we're out to lunch at Trostel's Dish. More to come. Well, that is good stuff.
That was, you know, my office is only a mile away. I'm a little scared. This place is pretty darn good.
Just a mile away. You could be here often. All right, so what you said to us earlier, John Norris, was that you tend to stay away from pasta because of your experiences in Rome. You just had risotto. Well,
some very good risotto. I mean, I'll first start with, I'm always, you know, a side salad that surprises you that's big and tasty was awesome. And as U.S. pasta makers go, this place is right up there. Yeah.
They got it. All right, so there you go. Thank you very much, Trostle's Dish. We're out to lunch with John Norris. He is a partner at the State Public Policy Group, SPPG. You can find them on Twitter as well. Nicole, that was delicious.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You just rocked the house. I don't know what you do to those Brussels sprouts. But, it just knocks out. Yeah.
Every time I smell them, I'm like, okay, I'm getting them.
Yeah, I got to get Brussels sprouts. I mean, who would think? Brussels
sprouts.
They're
like the new discovered vegetable, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so.
I know. They're, yeah.
But how they did them here?
Yeah, they were good.
Yeah,
huh?
Good. So you're going to head back to the office, write a report.
Yes.
What are the hot topics that your group's working on now?
Well, we just finished a statewide feasibility study for an Iowa nonprofit association. They're going to meet next week, decide if they want to go forward. Iowa's one of only seven states in the country that does not have a statewide nonprofit association to advance the cause for the nonprofit sector.
That's amazing.
Which is 13% of our economy.
Right.
And it's a billion-dollar industry in Iowa. So that's been very fascinating. I'm doing some work on energy, trying to advance clean energy into the Midwest, which is why I was so excited that Governor Reynolds is now going to chair the Midwest Governors Association and make renewable energy and transmission her priority. We run the statewide After School Care Alliance for kids, so we try and advance the cause for after school care for kids. That's what's fun about my work is I deal in energy and ag and education and nonprofit world, and so
lots of things.
Makes it easy to go in and work.
Lots of things. Politically for John Norris, what do you think? You want back in the saddle at any time? Never say never.
No, you know, I knew. I never say never. I certainly have no plans. I don't wake up one day thinking about how I can run for office again.
Yeah. So it's a grind, isn't it?
It is. And it may, you know, so maybe it happens again. I wasn't planning on the last run for governor. But, you know, Tom Vilsack took me to lunch before many people were in the race and encouraged me to run. And
right.
So I
remember that.
I explored it for about 3 or 4 months. And
it was kind of fun getting the old crew back together.
It was.
Yeah,
and I enjoyed the run. You know, I love the state, and I love traveling on the state. You meet so many great people. But, you know, I'll look for ways to have an input and make a difference. May not be running for office.
You were very forceful a couple of weeks ago up in Stuart, Iowa. It was called the Rural Voters Summit. And we touched on that just a little bit ago. What's the prescription for the Iowa Democratic Party to communicate with rural Iowans? What do they got to do?
Well, I think our calling at Storm Lake Times gave us our first order of business, which is show up.
Yeah, hello?
And I use that from Art a lot, and it's great. He said, you got to show up. If you don't show up, you're not in the game, you're not in the hunt for the vote, and you don't deserve it. And I agree. But then you've got to take some time to understand the issues and the challenges for rural Iowa and rural America. And there are many, but there's ways to address all of them. So then you've got to have a vision that can give people hope and take them away from this blame game and give them a hopeful path forward. So I think that's the trio. Show up, listen, understand, take time to learn what's happened to rural Iowa and rural America, and have a passion for issues and a vision that can change the direction. So that's, I think we lose a lot of, I'm seeing the presidentials, we lose a lot of them right in the, taking the time to understand. We'll pick off certain issues, broadband or Medicaid or issues that more closely link to what government can fund and subsidize.
Sure.
But we have to realize that what populated rural Iowa was, and what populates a lot of places, is your natural resources, our quality land and quality water, and how do we get people more engaged in the production of food safely and sustainably? And if we're going to repopulate the ag sector in Iowa, it's not going to be with large-scale commodity farmers. Those are shrinking.
Of course.
It's going to be with the new passion that especially the next generation has for being more closely connected to how our food is grown, who grows our food, where does it come from. And we know that the challenge is income on those. It takes a while. And they don't have health care, so you got to have a spouse or a partner who's got to have a job in town. Well, or work from home, which means you do have to have broadband, you have to have healthcare services, good education system. So all those are fundamental building blocks that we have to put in place to be able to attract the transition in agriculture to a sustainable agricultural system and all the businesses and supporting manufacturing that goes with that. But we've got to get back to that basic of connecting to the land for our life and our livelihood.
And that connection to the land, there are powerful forces out there, John, and we all have to admit, that don't want to see that happen.
Oh, no, the Farm Bureau's dream is 10 farmers per county, and let's get rid of people because they're neighbors, and neighbors are a problem if we want to put in, 20,000 hogs and pollute the hell out of our land and stink the place up to God heavens. That'd be a lot easier to do if there weren't people living out there.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that's the vision right now. The vision from the Farm Bureau and pork producers is we have about 15,000 animal confinement centers, but we have the land capacity for 47,000. You know how much waste 47,000 confinement centers? The equivalent of about a half a billion human beings.
On the same land mass have as Iowa.
We need to dispose of. And you think that's not going to affect our water supply? It's just insane. We've lost the connection between plant agriculture and animal agriculture, and we've got to reconnect that. So it's a healthy environment and not just utilizing our land to dump in chemicals and dump our waste.
It's a scary thought moving forward because you have children, I have children, and they're going to inherit whatever we leave behind, and it had best be to their benefit rather than to their detriment.
I mean certainly it would be a challenge for anyone to you live in rural Iowa now. You live in fear that hog confinement is going to go in next to you, or you won't be able to get water from the groundwater like we used to have our private well. Right. I grew up with
sure.
And it's changing out there fast, folks. Here in Iowa it's changing fast, and if we don't take a time out and say, is this really the direction we want for our future? We're going to find ourselves there.
John Norris, ladies and gentlemen, we've been out to lunch at Trostel's Dish. John, thanks so much, man, for doing this and reconnecting and telling your story. And I think it's a visionary story when you start to encompass all of what we call home, yep, which is Iowa, and how interdependent we really are. And as soon as urban folks figure out that, I think we're all going to be better off.
We're drinking the same waters.
John, thanks again.
You bet. Great to be here.
Once again, that was our friend John Norris from the State Public Policy Group. We were out to lunch at Trostel's Dish. Yum. I got to tell you, the Brussels sprouts were the best thing I think I've ever had in a long, long, long time. You got to try it. We will have links to the State Public Policy Group up on the radio blog. And once again, our thanks to Trostel's Dish and John Norris so that we could go out to lunch and have that conversation and you get to listen in. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe to our daily podcast. We do the business news each and every day, Monday through Friday. And also, we do the business news on Sunday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on News Talk 1540 KXEL in Waterloo. All you have to do to find us is Google Insight on Business, the News Hour, and we should be right there. Thanks again for listening. For all of us associated with the Business News Hour, Chap Ramsey is our production coordinator. Sales and marketing falls to Aaron Libby. The voice of the Business News Hour is Hunter Pease. And the music you're listening to right now is arranged, composed, and conducted by our friend James Goodlett from Jam Good Productions, exclusively for the Business News Hour. For all those folks and for John Norris, my name's Michael Libby. Have yourself a wonderful evening. Be safe, be well, be careful. Most of all, be good to your fellow man. Good day.